When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
People very often ask me both how and why I started my podcasting journey. Well, as an engineer, I'm frankly very passionate about math. I wanted to find somewhere to share stories of great mathematicians from Archimedes to Alan Turing and everyone in between. And for that reason, I want to tell you a little bit about my preferred hosting platform, which is Zencastr. Now, before I continue, this is usually the conversation I have with anybody who is wanting to start their own podcast. I know there are so many people out there with passions that they want to share with the world or unique knowledge that they're just looking for a platform to start with. And Zencastr is a wonderful all-in-one platform. What I mean by that is you can do your recording and your editing and use AI to create a transcript and distribute to all platforms, including Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anywhere else where podcasts are played. For anybody like me who might worry at first about what you might sound like on an audio recording, Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound really, really smooth. It automatically removes any of the ums or ahs in your recording. It removes any of the awkward pauses in conversations, and it also helps you to set the right podcast loudness and levels while reducing any background noise all with the click of a button. It couldn't be easier. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code BREAKINGMATH and you'll get 30% off your first month in any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience I do for all my podcasting and content needs. It's time to share your story.
Welcome to another episode of Breaking Math. I am one of your hosts, Gabriel Hesch, and I'm joined by my host, Autumn Fanoff. How are you, Autumn?
I'm well. How are you?
Outstanding. Thank you for joining us. And I'm thrilled to say that we have a new book author today. We are interviewing Steve Natas, who is the author of this awesome book called The Gravity of Math. How are you doing today, Steve?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Gabe.
Absolutely. I couldn't be more happy to have you join us. It's very, very exciting. A few things about this book, Gravity of Math. This book is about, of course, the mathematics of gravity going back to Isaac Newton, including Albert Einstein and gravitational waves and black holes, as well as some recent developments, some recent ideas involving things like string theory and how the concept of mass isn't really all that well defined. We've got a whole list of questions here about this awesome book. I also want to tell you a little bit about the authors. If you guys want to interrupt me because you've got more to say on this, please do so. First, I'll talk about Steve Natas. Steve Natas is a contributing editor to Discover magazine. He's also a contributing writer to Quanta magazine. Quanta, by the way, I think is one of my new favorite magazines. Every episode we've done so far, Quanta has done multiple articles on. The last one that we did with Quanta was involving some of their articles in the Lean Theorem Prover. Very interesting concept. Essentially, it's our previous episode. Imagine something like the game Operation, where it buzzes you if you go out of line, and it's supposed to help you to write math theorems without contradicting yourself or your established definitions. It's pretty cool. Quanta has written quite a bit about that as well, so I like hearing from other authors of that magazine. Also, I'd like to talk about the other author. Xingtun Yao is a mathematical professor at Tsinghua University and a professor emeritus at Harvard University. He's also the recipient of the Fields Medal, the National Medal of Science, and a MacArthur Fellowship, and he currently lives in Beijing. And he has written, Steve Natas has co-authored 5 books with Xingtun Yao, and we have the latest book with us here today. So again, I already said thank you for joining us, and there's just so much to talk about here. During our pre-interview, we discovered something pretty cool, and that is that both my co-host Autumn and Steve Natas went to the same university. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
So we were chit-chatting about our backgrounds before the show, and it geographically, it was like, where are you located? And you said Cambridge, and I'm like, okay, I'm in Massachusetts. And I'm kind of by UMass. the other side of the state. We proceed to discover I went to UMass, and he's like, oh, my undergrad was in the area. And I'm going, okay, right in that area, there's 5 colleges. I have taken classes on 4 out of 5 campuses during my time for my undergraduate career. And I was like, wait, did you go to Amherst? And I'm thinking he's done physics. I'm like, did you go to UMass? No, our favorite school, Hampshire College. college. Think of the party hardy hipster college that has no grades, is really awesome and teaches people how to think creatively and very freely. On top of that, we share a couple of advisors and committee members who were Hampshire legends.
I'd like to continue that. So what's kind of cool is with the Breaking Math podcast, initially our heritage, I suppose, was strictly out of New Mexico. We were strictly out of UNM, University of New Mexico, as well as a little bit of New Mexico Tech, which was myself and my original co-host, the late, great Sophia Baca. And of course, now it's awesome because I've got a co-host who's got this entire cultural heritage from Hampshire. I'm sorry, am I saying it right? Hampshire.
Hampshire.
Yes. Yeah, in Massachusetts. And not only this, but also our guest author. And you guys even shared some of the same advisors?
We certainly had one physics professor in common. It's also the case that we were there at quite different eras. So it's only because that physics professor is over 80 that we know the same professor, because I was there in the 70s and much more recently. I don't want to nitpick, but we probably wouldn't apply the term university to Hampshire. Small college of not much more than 1,000 students at its peak. Above 1,000, but
It's had a lot of different folks that have come in, and they're also very well known for mathematics and mathematicians. So there's been a lot of interesting folks that have gone in there, even people who have done the aerodynamics of a frisbee as their thesis. So
let's add an article to that in the show notes. I'm now curious about that myself.
I think we mentioned it in a prior episode. Some of the inventions I got to find out that Stonyfield Farm yogurts, seventh generation cleaning products. There's medical devices where they have a backpack that was meant for a gynecological table that you could take to remote countries. They have a saying from Hampshire to Harvard or Hampshire to Hollywood. And it has so far proven true with the number of doctors, lawyers, and attorneys that come out of there.
Nice.
And just
nice.
Really cool, interesting people. So we're getting to Dr. One today.
Awesome.
I can't say that Frisbee was big in Hampshire. I started playing Ultimate Frisbee in the early days, and I can't say that many of those people at Hampshire who were playing started the Ultimate Frisbee Hall of Fame.
Yes.
But when I was in Hampshire, I just never thought it was a serious sport. It was only when I came during my graduation, I watched a game and I thought that was pretty fun, and maybe I'd missed out on that experience, but I had other experiences.
I think it was studying about the aerodynamics of the Frisbee.
That was someone's thesis.
Yes. I guess I'll ask you this before we move on to the book, and this is mostly for Steve. Do you guys have any advice for anybody who's considering going to school there for what ways to make the most of their education while they're there?
Well, I would say that it's really a great place for people who are kind of self-motivated and don't need to have someone tell them what to do and give them all kinds of written assignments and tell them what to read and what to write and what to think about. If you are a little more independent and have ideas, then you can get the guidance and the resources to pursue them. And so that's a place for, I think, someone who is very independent, or at least would like to be, and have the environment in order to kind of grow in that direction.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for sharing that bit of background. I think we'll go ahead and dive into the book here.
So out of curiosity, how did your collaboration with Yao start in 2006? It's been quite a long time to work with someone with a lot of books. So... We're curious to tell.
Well, that's a great question. And as is often the case in situations like this, I never expected that. I guess it's 18 years later, we're still collaborating. You can't see the future. But in any case, what it basically came about as follows. Yao was contacted by a literary agent, I think, and then he talked with a friend of his, a physicist who was also from China, and as to who might work with him on it. And this physicist named Henry Tai at Cornell University. I'm not sure if he still has ties with Cornell. He's at a university in Hong Kong now. He put me in touch with Yao. I sent Yao an email. He wrote back very quickly. He said, "Show me some things you've written." I sent him a few articles, and then he wrote back again. He said, "Well, when do you want to meet?" how about today? And so we met the afternoon. I thought we'd just have a general chat, but he wanted to get started working on the book right then. We didn't know what the book was going to be about, though, so that was a bit of a problem, or not a problem, but it was. So we started thinking about different options. He'd had a lot of accomplishments in math, and was a question of figuring out what would be the best one. And it took a while, actually, to figure that out. In fact, we had a conversation with that literary agent and, you know, mentioned some ideas and what he had in mind when he'd contacted Yao. And the agent was a little vague. He should have said, well, you know, it's up to you to decide, but I'm sure it'll be great. So then we went back to the drawing board and wrote the first book called The Shape of Inner Space. It's about the mathematics of string theory, which was an area that Yao had made really kind of fundamental contributions to. And that was all I thought we were going to do. But then at the end of that, he suggested something else.
So when you're talking with Yao here, how did you decide to write a book about gravity specifically?
Yeah, that actually did. It was a follow-up to the first book, even though this turns out to be the fifth book. There's a little gap there, but when our book on string theory came out, an editor from Cambridge University Press contacted Yao. I guess he thought he liked that book and wondered if we actually asked Yao whether we had an idea for a second book. And Yao said, how about a book on gravity? And he passed that on to me. And I kind of thought, you know, it's just, I filed that idea away. But before we got to that one, Yao had become the chair of Harvard Math Department. And I guess the chair of the MIT Math Department had just sent him a book about some famous mathematicians at MIT. And now that Yao was Harvard chair, he said, well, we've had some pretty famous mathematicians over the years and thought maybe a book on the history of mathematics at Harvard would be a good subject. That became our second book called A History in Sum. And it was about who had become chair of the math department and thought a book on the history of math at Harvard would be in order. And that led to our second book together, A History in Sum, which covered the years of 1800 to 1900. 18 was picked just because that was when the first Harvard mathematician actually published a paper that on a new mathematical research. Up until that time, professors were supposed to focus on writing textbooks and teaching, and the idea of breaking new ground in math had been discouraged. And so that's when math officially started at Harvard in our view. And we took it up as close to the present as we could, but we didn't want to get right up to the very day because things were changing. It wasn't always, you can't always tell how important the development will be unless you have to give it some time to see whether the result is really going to go somewhere or not. But going back to your earlier question, I forgot about gravity. So we ended up writing four books. And then when that was done, I remembered what Yao had said about book on gravity. And that's what really led to this current book. And what we thought was to focus on the mathematics of gravity, the mathematical underpinnings of our current theory of gravity. And the mathematics has been used to kind of explore the implications of this theory called general relativity, which was invented in 1905 by Einstein. And I should also say another reason that I thought this would be a good book is that Yao is one of the world's experts in the mathematics of general relativity, and he's made some big contributions in that area. So we would be well poised to take on that subject. That's sort of the genesis of it. What happened is we started to work on it in early 2020, and just as the pandemic was starting to rear its head, Yao had been thinking of going to China, and he decided he better not wait too long because travel may be difficult. And so he moved in early March of 2010. And so we basically worked on the book separately. And I actually haven't seen him since. He hasn't been back to the U.S.
Why did you think we needed another book about Einstein, gravity, and general relativity? There's a few out there already. So what makes this one different?
Yes, to say there is a few out there is maybe an understatement. And I certainly have not counted. But I did read somewhere that there had been 1,700 books on Einstein, and that doesn't necessarily include all the books on general relativity and gravity. So, yes, there's a lot out there, and our feeling was that a book that was really focused on mathematics would be new and could make a new contribution. Now, not totally new in the sense that for college students and especially graduate students, there are books on the mathematics of general relativity, but those are not books that the general public would read. They're quite dense. So That was really what we were thinking. But also, I think we realized that mathematics is an important way of understanding the universe, and that might not really be widely appreciated. That is certainly a theme that is developed in our book, just because we learn about the universe through some of these expensive science missions like the Hubble Space Telescope and the LIGO Gravitational Wave Observatories, the Virgo Gravitational Wave Observatories, this thing called the Event Horizon Telescope, which captured images of two black holes or silhouettes of two black holes. Very big projects. But before any of these projects were realized, there had been a lot of mathematics work that led to our understanding of these objects, understanding of things like black holes 100 years before we got a picture of them, and understanding of gravitational waves 100 years before the first ones were intercepted. So that's where we thought that, you know, what this book would talk about, how we can really understand the universe through mathematics, not mathematics alone, but mathematics is an important part of the picture.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And I want to mention real quick a few things. First of all, you talk about the mathematics specifically of general relativity. My former co-host, the late Sophia Baca, created a poster all about the mathematics of general relativity. We just call it our tensor poster. I'm going to put that on the website very, very soon, but we sell it. And I think the last price that we were selling it for was e to the pi dollars. I don't remember what that was. I'm going to have to check that out. But essentially, it was just the cost of production. She wanted to do it for free, just not for free, but for a very low cost, just to maximize the benefit. It's a gorgeous poster. Full disclosure, I have no idea what it says. I shouldn't say that. That's not entirely true. So I have, you know, a master's degree in electrical engineering, and we did linear algebra, and we did calculus up through calculus 3, and we did a lot of physics. So it's got that, but it's an extension. So it's a lot of it that I don't even know what it says, but it looks so pretty. So for those who have an appreciation for the aesthetic and want to see some pretty math posters and want to try to figure out and reinforce your understanding of general relativity, shoot us an email. If I don't have the shop set up on the website yet, shoot us an email at breakingmathpodcast@gmail.com. I'll send you a picture of the poster and see if you want a copy. And Mr. Natus, if you'd like a free copy, I like to give one to all of our guests. I'd love to send you one if you'd like.
It would be great. I'd like to see it for sure.
Oh, fantastic.
E to the pi dollars is $23.14.
Yes. There you go. There you go. Yeah. I believe that was the last part. That was Sophia's idea, and I thought it was terrific. So I'll send one for you, and I'd like to send one to Xingcheng Yao. I'd have to get an appropriate shipping address. We can talk about that after the episode. So yeah. And I think aside from this, the only other thing I'll say is we have other episodes too. We did an entire 3 episodes on evolving models of black holes. How they've changed has been just so fascinating. I'm not going to spoil all that here because I want this to be your episode. But the models of black holes has changed in ways where I can't even make intuitive sense of the current models that involve things like a firewall and an ice wall and things like that. So yeah, do you have much interest in black holes yourself?
Well, yes, quite a bit. We have a chapter in the book devoted to black holes, and I've written, I couldn't count the number of articles, but I know many dozens of articles on black holes. So it's one of my favorite subjects, and there's a lot of mysteries still to be unearthed there, so we haven't exhausted that subject yet.
Awesome. You know what? And I may go off script here. I have two questions. One of my favorite dinner time conversations is trying to explain to somebody that's never heard of this, the difference between a neutron star and a black hole. I'll just add that because I love that conversation. I should make that script available for anybody who wants to download it who's nerdy like I am. But my question is, in the last, let's say, 12 years, I have not kept up with developments in ideas and models of black holes. Do you know of any major changes in thinking paradigms over these last 12 years, per se?
Well, let's see. I mean, there certainly have been, this might not go right to your question, but certainly on the sort of observational end, there has been, you know, major advances in the last, I guess, probably 8 or 9 years, because in 2000, the first gravitational, that was, you know, what the physicists believe, product of two large black holes colliding and producing gravitational waves, which were detected. And so that's some of the earliest solid evidence for black holes. There had been other evidence that might be somewhat more indirect. But then a few years after that, in 2009, was when the first image of a black hole was taken by this network of, I think, at least a dozen radio telescopes around the globe, including Greenland and Antarctica and other continents, which got a picture. It's called the first image of a black hole. You can't actually see the black hole part of it, but you can see right up to it, the edge of it. And so that goes very far in terms of confirmation of the ideas. But I think you were referring more to some of the conceptual breakthroughs, and there is just many things to talk about, almost too many to go into here. But I can say that this did not get in our book because it's so new, but I met with two mathematicians just the last month who have proven that a type of black hole called an extremal black hole, which is a black hole which has the maximum possible charge or the maximum possible spin, can actually exist. Whereas a law that had been so-called law, a physical law, had been proposed in 60 years ago by John Bardeen, a Nobel laureate, Stephen Hawking, and Brandon Carter, who said that an object like that could not exist. And now the mathematicians have taken issue with that, and this is kind of brand new. They say that objects like this can exist and could be observable in the sky. I should say, though, that the fact that something is proven to be mathematically plausible does not guarantee that such things will exist in nature. But what it does show is that the arguments that had been presented before saying that they couldn't exist were faulty. And so that's a brand new possibility, and it has certain implications, which I could go into now. But basically the idea was that if you had an extremal black hole and you were to add a little bit more spin to it, let's just say that there's been a lot of thinking on black holes, and it's subject is in some sense it's an old one, but there are new papers on it maybe every day. I think it would be surprising if there isn't a new paper on black holes every day. Okay. That goes in archives.
I'll have to see. One of the things that we tried to do, rather, when I was trying to dive into black holes, I read the book, The Black Hole War. That's part of the title, by Leonard Susskind. Are you familiar with that work?
I'm not familiar with the book, but I think I am probably familiar with some of the ideas in it, but I can't.
Okay.
Comment on the book specifically.
That's an interesting book. I cannot say it is my favorite book, but it was still an absolute delight. I think that, not to go into great detail here, I understood about 2/3 of the book, and then the last third was completely lost on me. This is Leonard Susskind, who I think has made himself quite a name. He tried to argue with Stephen, I mean, you probably know this, he argued with Stephen Hawking for over 30 years, arguing that the information paradox is incorrect, but he couldn't quite figure out why. And I think it was a documentary originally made in Britain, I believe, and I think it's just called The Information Paradox. Oh gosh, I'm going to have to Google search it. But essentially, it was an entire documentary that talked about the staggering implications of the information paradox. And is that something that you feel comfortable talking to somebody about? And if not, perfectly fine. Are you comfortable talking about what is meant by the information paradox?
Well, I could comment on that. It wasn't a subject covered in our book, just because I don't know of sort of the mathematical aspect of it. We focused on issues where mathematics has advanced our understanding, and I don't know that it has in this case. But the basic issue here is the idea of Hawking radiation, that the idea that black holes, are basically nothing can escape a black hole, was the initial idea. But Stephen Hawking actually proposed this mechanism called Hawking radiation, where black holes would leak and radiate away basically matter over time, a process that can be compared to like evaporation, so that in an incredibly long time, and I can't even give you a number right now, that black holes, a large black hole, would disappear. The question is whether information, in quantum theory holds that information shouldn't be destroyed, and is that process of Hawking radiation and the evaporation's black hole, is that in conflict with this quantum theory of information conservation, basically? So that is the issue as to how, I don't know the details of what Hawking had wagered and what Leonard Susskind said, but that's sort of what it's about. It's not something that we delved into in the book because I hadn't heard of really important mathematics that kind of cast that subject in a new light and maybe edified us on that point.
Okay, awesome. I'd be curious at some point. And I don't mean to spend so much time on that one. I'm very curious about your work as well. How did Einstein formulate the equations of general relativity in 1915? And what mathematical help did he get along the way?
Yes, well, I guess one point that we made in our book, and before getting to the actual equations, which is quite a lengthy story, is that what Einstein did in formulating these equations was tremendous. tremendous feat and maybe one of the greatest theoretical advances, you know, in the history of science. But it is often said that this was the greatest achievement of the single human mind. And the achievement was amazing, and no credit should be taken away from Einstein for what he did. But it wasn't quite, he didn't do it entirely on his own. He did get some help along the way. Once he realized that the problem was going to involve geometry and a kind of geometry called non-Euclidean geometry, basically geometry of curved spaces, something, a subject he really did not know about, then he realized that he was going to need help. And in 1920, he went to a friend of his, a former classmate from college, Marcel Grossmann, who was then at the same university in Zurich that he had gone as an undergraduate, ETH, and asked him for help, because he was wrestling with these ideas from physics for this new way of a new conception of gravity, and it somehow involved a form of geometry that he was unfamiliar with. And Grossmann very quickly, maybe within the course of a day, told him that what he needed was ideas of a form of gravity that had been invented in the 18th by Bernhard Riemann. And he told him that that's what you need, but that wasn't all you needed. As you mentioned tensors and tensor calculus, this was something else that Einstein wasn't familiar with, and there was work that had been done, a kind of very important work by Gregorio Ricci and Tullio Levi-Civita, two Italian mathematicians who worked out tensor calculus, and Grossmann introduced Einstein to this as well, and that started to give some of the tools that one could use to kind of formulate the equations. But it was a long road, and even before he got there, I guess this is a big question, because there were many steps in the process. It actually, Einstein in 1900 published four major papers, one of which was on special relativity. And then the next step after that special relativity paper was to find a general theory. Special relativity described physics of physical systems that are in constant motion. And to do a theory of gravity will require accelerated motion, was something Einstein realized. And therefore, special relativity was a special case, a case when velocities are constant and objects move relative to each other. Let me back up there. Special relativity describes systems that are at constant velocity. Einstein recognized that he was going to need to generalize that theory to include accelerated motions in order to describe a theory of gravity. Now, how he came to that stemmed from a discovery he made, sort of a thought experiment in 1900, something called the equivalence principle. This is something that Einstein said was one of the greatest things, his realizations he ever had. Basically, that person falling from a roof during at least the interval in flight, wouldn't feel any gravity. And what he basically discovered here, why it's called the equivalence principle, is he established an equivalence between gravitation and acceleration. And one way to think about that is that suppose you're in an elevator or something that seems like an elevator, and you suddenly feel yourself pressing against the floor. Is that because the force of gravity is pushing you down, or is it because the elevator is accelerating upwards? There's no way for you to tell the difference. And that was one of the principles that started him on this path, the equivalence between gravitation and acceleration. There were several other key elements that he needed in order to put this theory together, and this is where he got help, at least indirectly.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From someone else, his former math teacher invented the concept of space-time. He said that we can no longer, for physics questions like this, can no longer think of space, three-dimensional space, and time as separate, but we have to think of them together as a four-dimensional space-time. Now,
out of curiosity, didn't Emmy Noether also have some sort of contribution in this effort as well?
Well, her contributions come later. I think I should get to describe the equations of general relativity before we get to that, because she really was looking at analyzing the equations after they were sort of formulated in 19... So maybe I was going on too long. Yeah, there's a lot to say here. What should we do now?
If you want to talk a little bit about the equations and just go from there, where do they take place into it, and how does that add right into that little bit of a story?
Okay.
You said his teacher, it wasn't Minkowski?
I was talking about Minkowski. He invented the notion of four-dimensional space-time. That turned out. So should I pick off from there and maybe?
Sure, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just back up to 1900. Einstein's former college math professor, Hermann Minkowski, gave a speech in which he talked about how we can no longer, in doing physics, or at least physics of this sort, think of space and time as separate, that they had to be put together. We know of three dimensions of space that we can see, and there's time, and he said we have to think of this concept of space-time, a four-dimensional space-time, rather than three dimensions of space and one of time. Now, Einstein did not think much of that idea when he originally heard it. It took 4 years until 1900 Einstein recognized that it was the setting, four-dimensional space-time, was the setting in which he needed to write his theory of this new theory of gravity. And so he put his ideas about the equivalence principle, the equivalence of gravitation and acceleration, together with this four-dimensional space-time. And then there was also Riemannian geometry that had been developed in the 18th. That was another kind of key ingredient. Those were some of the ingredients he needed, along with tensor calculus. So now he has to try to put together these theories of gravity. Initially, he worked with his friend, the geometer, Marcel Grossmann. And in 19, they came up with the first draft of the equations of general relativity. That paper that Einstein wrote the physics part, Grossmann wrote the mathematics part. And it came very close to getting things right. But it didn't quite work, and there was one big defect in it, in that one of the guiding principles from the start in this endeavor for Einstein and Grossmann when they're working together was that these equations that they write should not depend on what coordinate systems we choose to label things. And that concept is called general covariance. But they got into problems writing these equations, and they had to give up on that to some extent. And That hurt the theory a lot. They decided then that they could not make a generally covariant theory and that it was impossible. But their arguments for that turned out to be wrong. And it took Einstein a while to recognize that. And it took him actually 2 more years to establish a fully covariant theory. And what that means is a theory that means that physics is physics and the coordinate systems are chosen arbitrarily by, say, human observers. How we choose to put the coordinates, where we put, if we think of a graph, say, where we choose to put the origin, should not change how physics works. And that ultimately, he got a theory that did that, but it was 2 very hard years of work. I can describe the equations now. Should I say a little bit about them? Right. So in November of 19, Einstein published, November 25th, 19, published these equations of general relativity, which are still with us today. And let's just say that, I'll try to say it in words. Capital G with subscript IJ equals capital T IJ. And in some ways, that's the whole thing. It doesn't seem so hard. Just 2 letters. It doesn't even fill hardly any lines on it. Not maybe a single line on a page. But as these turn out to be, it's not just nearly as simple as that, because the G term and the T term are tensors, which are basically kind of like matrices. 4x4 arrays, but each one of them is not necessarily a single number, but it can be a function. And what you end up with It's not just this simple equation, simple-looking equation, Gij equals Tij. What you have is 16 equations, and they're 16 nonlinear partial differential equations, which turn out to be very hard to solve individually.
Always are.
Always are, and you have to solve not just one, but 16 of them simultaneously, which makes it very difficult. But let me just say, I mentioned these letters, but what does it mean? What does it have to do with? The left side of the equation has to do with the curvature of space-time, and the right-hand side has to do with sort of the matter and energy in space-time. And so what the equation basically says is that matter and energy curve space-time, and the curvature part of the equation includes different kinds of... Einstein needed to incorporate different kinds of, not just one kind of curvature. There are different kinds of curvatures and different dimensions. So it was a very detailed geometric description of what, how, say, concentrations of mass and energy, what they do to the time, space and time around them, and how they curve things. Now, it sounds a little abstract, but I can try to make it a little clearer. If you think of gravity, basically what Einstein said, the previous picture of gravity that we'd had for several hundred years that Isaac Newton developed and is valid in most cases, you know, in everyday situations. It's not valid in extreme cases like the environment around a black hole. But that kind of, that notion invoked an invisible force, an attractive force between massive objects. Einstein kind of changed that picture entirely. He said that massive objects curve space and time around them. You can think of, say, putting a bowling ball on a rubber sheet that's stretched out, and you have little smaller balls that are on that sheet that will now be drawn towards the bowling ball because it's going to create a bit of a cavity around it. And so that is basically the essence of gravity. Gravity is a consequence of the curvature of space-time, and the curvature of space-time can be considered, tells you the shape of space-time or its geometry. So gravity is really a consequence of geometry, and then therefore you have this equation on one side, you have mass and energy, the stuff that kind of creates the gravitation, and then on the left side you have the curvature of space-time that corresponds to it. And it's an entirely different picture of what we had before, but it's a picture that's held up for very well for more than 100 years.
You know, I think what you just said there, if I may be so bold to interrupt here, when you talked about the rubber sheet analogy, when I was in high school, maybe I was eighth grade or so, that was the first time I ever saw that. And nothing impacted me in terms of my love of science and physics specifically as much as seeing the analogy of the rubber sheet, CGI analogy of the rubber sheet example of space-time. Now, I know that that's not a completely accurate model. I've heard plenty of criticisms, but I wanted to point out a few examples of where the audience, the listeners can find it. I think it's available on the PBS or Nova websites. I will find it and put the link in the show notes. And then I also realized I have permission to even show a small clip of it. The first time I saw it, I think, was in The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene, where you, again, you've got a CGI example where he did this great three-dimensional grid with these white lines, and he showed where the sun is, and he showed how the grid lines come together exactly as they would on a rubber sheet. And then it just shows the movement of the planets that follow the contours of the bending of space. They are utterly spectacular. He does it not only in The Elegant Universe, which I will hopefully have a clip of, but he also does it in a follow-up called The Fabric of the Cosmos, where I think he used a billiards board, pool table instead. But again, just that visual alone, I think, communicates the idea in such a glorious, spectacular fashion that, yeah, just the fact that, you know, in a simple visual, you can show this beautiful analogy. I think it's wonderful. I think it is absolutely wonderful. Gosh, are you familiar with any criticisms of that analogy yourself?
I think that the basic analogy holds it. I'm sure that there would be some renderings of it that would be maybe some poetic licenses taken or may not be accurate. But that is the essence of general relativity. And, you know, as I said, it's not a new idea. You know, it goes back to 19th and even to the earlier work of Einstein, and Grossman didn't get things quite right, but going back even a couple of years before then. But it is not necessarily how people think of gravity in, you know, everyday life, and it's not necessarily germane to our everyday experience, but it is actually a very mathematical and geometric interpretation, which is sort of kind of at the heart of what this book is about, to show the importance of mathematics and geometry, not only in developing the theory and in creating these equations that are, you know, a geometric, you know, really equations about geometry, but also in understanding what this, unpacking that theory, because it's been 100 years and it hasn't been fully fully unpacked even yet. And there's a lot of mathematics has paved the way for some scientific discoveries made, you know, through astronomical observations and experiments in laboratories.
Actually, I do have one big question for you. So gravity's been around for 109 years. What else is there? What's new to discuss about it?
Well, let's just say that... Well, gravity's been around. I mean, as you know, gravity's been around before we were here.
Yep.
This way of thinking of gravity has been around 100 years. But I guess there are new things to say about general relativity, and there are papers on it pretty much coming out, probably more than one a day, and big discoveries. Some of the discoveries are actually just ever more stringent, precise experiments testing Einstein's ideas, and so far they've all held up. And others just kind of amplify on what we've known before. For instance, in 2000, the first gravitational waves were discovered. Now, gravitational waves, Einstein predicted in a 19th paper, came out 1 year after the equations of general relativity were published. Now, he produced equations that described what happens when a massive object moves through space-time, could create ripples, so-called gravitational waves, kind of like if you have a boat, you send it on a powerboat and send it on a pond that's completely placid and it speeds along, it's going to create waves where there were none through that motion. And Einstein believed that a phenomenon like that would happen with massive objects moving through space-time. Okay, as I said, that was in 2000. 900 years later, scientists from the LIGO and Virgo collaborations, gravitational waves, announced the discovery of the first gravitational waves. Now, just last year, for instance, something new, and I should say that in the intervening years, gravitational waves have been detected from maybe 100 other sources. Sources typically include collisions between black holes, a collision between neutron stars, or even a collision between a black hole and a neutron star. You need truly massive objects moving very fast, possibly at half the speed of light, in order to create waves that can be detected here. As to what's new, I should say that last year was discovered evidence that there is not just we have detected isolated cases of gravitational waves. It appears to be a background of gravitational wave everywhere you look in the sky. The product of not a single collision between two black holes, but rather sort of the combined residue of hundreds, maybe hundreds of thousands of black hole collisions, or maybe even millions of collisions over, you know, eons. And that's kind of, it seems to be a permanent feature, a kind of a background feature in the sky. So that's something that wasn't known before. There are new ideas about black holes. Our book focuses on, that's not on the math end, what I just discovered. Our book focuses more on the mathematical things. But there was a paper that came out by two mathematicians last year, which looks at whether black holes could exist not just in the three dimensions of space that we know about, or the four-dimensional space-time in which general relativity is set, but could there be black holes in higher dimensions? Now, Stephen Hawking proved that in three dimensions, spatial dimensions, or four-dimensional space-time, black holes have to be spherical in shape. And by saying the shape of a black hole, referring to the event horizon of a black hole, has to be spherical. These mathematicians prove that in higher dimensions, you could have all kinds of different shapes. Now, and black holes can exist in these higher dimensions mathematically, and they wouldn't be limited to having a spherical shapes. That does not mean that these things actually exist in nature, but they're possible now. It's something that one could look at for, and one may even be able to look for signs of them in accelerated physics experiments like the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva. And their ideas, how you might see evidence of higher dimensions, which we don't even know that the higher dimensions exist. But that might be one way of finding out if you see an object that couldn't exist, or remnants of an object that couldn't exist in four dimensions. Space-time, that would be, yes. So those are just a couple of there's just new findings coming out all the time. This theory was presented in 1915, and people haven't stopped analyzing it and making new discoveries.
I have a couple of questions myself. There's something interesting that I want to talk to you about in this book, and that's that Yao talks about mass specifically not being a very well-defined concept in general relativity. Can you explain what does he mean by not being well-defined?
Yes, that is a good question, and it's a hard one in a way, because you would think that was almost the simplest thing. And, you know, we've had mass, you know, if you go back to Isaac Newton's equations from the force equals mass times acceleration, mass is kind of just a basic idea, and it doesn't seem that hard. And it is, I can't actually explain why it has been so elusive in general relativity. But let me say that the way it has been defined, and it's the most rigorous way of defining mass in general relativity, I think is to think of the following. You can think of the mass of an object that's isolated. Say you have a black hole and you go very far away. In theory, you would say almost infinitely far away. And if your theory holds, that as you get far and farther away from massive objects, things, dense objects like black holes that curve space-time, the farther and farther away you go, the flatter and flatter space gets. From that point, you can actually determine the mass of that physical system. But we don't have great tools in general relativity to work out the mass of things from close up. For instance, it's considered impossible to define the mass at a single point. What work that my co-author Yao has been involved in and made very big contributions in is trying to get a more, let's say, a sharper picture of mass than having to go out very far away, if not to infinity, just far enough away from, say, a black hole that things will be calm enough that you can do it. This is called quasi-local mass. So basically you could look at a system that's not just a single object, but you could have a system that it might include two black holes, and you could try to get a sense of the mass of each of them rather than looking at the whole system far away and determining its mass. Now, I wish I could answer your question better as to why this is so difficult.
No, it's all good.
So I did want to say how people have attacked this problem a little bit. And the first kind of definition of quasi-local mass, which means was advanced in the 19th by Stephen Hawking. And he thought, well, you can take like a black hole, and you have to assume that it's a perfectly spherical object. You look at how light rays come in and how they would be deflected by that mass, and then you can get an estimate of what the mass is. That's one approach that people have taken. The only thing is that spherical symmetry is a kind of a special thing to insist on and not really necessarily found in nature. Another mathematician, Robert Bartnik, came up with an idea that you could take this physical system with some mass and put a surface around it and then expand that surface out towards infinity or to a great distance from which you can then determine the mass inside. But he said you can expand that surface, like you could think of it as like a balloon, flexible thing that could be expanded in different ways. And depending on how you expand it, the mass that is smallest is the best definition of that mass inside there. Now, Yao and his co-author, Mutao Wang at Columbia University, have what's now considered to be the best definition. And again, it's very technical. It's a little frustrating that mass is so difficult. But what they basically say is that you can find a two-dimensional surface to surround a physical system. It could be their solar system, or it could be black hole or a binary black hole. And you can look at basically the curvature of that surface, and the curvature of that surface will give you the measure of the mass. And so it's a very hard, you can't just put things on a scale. And part of the fact that this theory is nonlinear means everything is affecting everything else, and there's all kinds of strange feedback that makes things hard. But right now, I think that most people believe that what Yao and his co-author Mutao Wang have the best definition of quasi-local mass that you don't have to actually go out as far as infinity to measure. But let me just say that, even now, that's the best. You have to solve some very difficult differential equations. It's not easy to use. The Bartnik solution is considered very mathematically elegant, but no one knows if it can actually be solved. So it's not, I should say that even today, this problem isn't solved, but there have been advances, and there are recent advances by Yao and his colleagues. Once they have this definition of quasi-local mass, then they can get definitions of angular momentum. You have a mass that is moving and maybe orbiting in a circle, and now they have a new definition of quasi-local angular momentum.
Us a little bit about Yao's contributions?
Yes, well, his contributions, I think I've been alluding to some of them, and he's helping, and made some big contributions to helping us think about mass in general relativity and think about other basic concepts like angular momentum. But I think he's contributed in several other areas, kind of important contributions. I believe I referred to this earlier in our conversation. 19th was the first of Roger Penrose papers on singularities theorems. He basically talked about how certain kinds of situations in which singularities would arise, something called a closed trap surface. He proved if you have a closed trap surface, that will lead to a singularity. Now, what is a closed trap surface? It's basically a surface that is collapsing in a way such that If you have, say, light, a source of light in the middle, you will shoot it out towards the edges of this surface, and it will wrap around and come back into the middle. And so, in any case, so Roger Penrose wrote a series of singularity theorems starting in the 60s, and then including some work with Stephen Hawking. Penrose won a Nobel Prize in Physics in 2003 for that work, but his work didn't show mathematically how you get a closed-trap surface. And this is work that Yao and his co-author, Rick Shane, did what's called the black hole existence proof. So basically, Penrose showed that if you have a closed-trap surface, you'll get a singularity. But in order to say how you get black holes, you have to show how you get that closed-trap surface. And so this was work that Yao did with Shane called black hole existence theorem. So basically proved mathematically how you can get a black hole. And this was done in the late 70s, before there was actual proof that black holes exist, even though there was some, you know, evidence from astrophysicists that there were black holes out there. And so having this black hole existence proof, it's mathematics. It doesn't mean that there are black holes out in the sky or in the center of our galaxy, which we now believe to be the case in the center of every large galaxy, basically. But that's kind of what you might call a precondition. Mathematics existence proofs show that these objects make mathematical sense. They're mathematically consistent. And soon thereafter, we started accumulating more and more evidence that black holes really do exist and are quite abundant, in fact. So that is one thing. Yao also worked with the same co-author, Rick Shane, on work that's called the positive energy theorem, which in some ways, it's a little oversimplification to say this, but proves that an isolated physical system has energy must be positive or at least energy is non-negative. Energy is either zero or positive. And that proof, in some ways, could be applied to our universe. In some ways, a physical system, an isolated physical system, the energy has to be non-negative. And it's not quite fair to say that applies to our universe, but it could apply to our universe, tell us that we have positive energy. That is a bit of a leap going to the universe. There are some caveats one would attach to that. But those are some of the areas that he's made big contributions. And he's made huge contributions to string theory, which is a theory that combines our theory of gravity with the theory of quantum physics. So he has been quite a big player in this area. And so I was lucky to have him, certainly very fortunate to have him as the co-author of this book on the mathematics of gravity.
Wow. Yeah. So I guess the one thing I want to ask you, things you most would like to talk about in these last five. It could be more of the same book. It could be your other books, things that you'd like to go on in the future, or anything that you would like. The floor is yours.
Well, I guess I would like to take up Autumn's question, one, and maybe another one that was on the list.
Sure, so absolutely.
Do I need to just, I don't need to have a slow, so I'll just go right in.
Yeah, we can cut it out if need be.
Yes, yeah, so Autumn asked about Emmy Noether's contributions to this, and I think that's kind of an interesting story. I didn't pronounce the name so well. It's a German name, Emmy Noether, a mathematician from Germany who has made huge contributions in the area of algebra, a great pioneer, had a difficult, interesting story in that she could not go to, women were not admitted to universities when she was of college age. She had to audit classes. Eventually, she was able to get permission to study and earned a PhD, and then she did great work, but she couldn't actually get a job because of being a woman in Germany. And she was also Jewish, and I don't know the years, but I believe sometime in the 30s emigrated to the U.S. And she finally did get a job teaching at Bryn Mawr College, although she became ill and did not live long after she had finally gotten a professor job, even though she was quite an illustrious mathematician. But let's go back up to 1900. Einstein come out with these theories of general relativity, the equations that describe gravity. And he was then doing work in Germany. And there's a famous mathematician there, David Hilbert, at the University of Göttingen, which was the world's leading center of mathematics, along with Felix Klein, another major mathematician there, invited Emmy Noether to come there to look into the issue of energy conservation and the theories of the equations of general relativity to make sure energy was conserved, which is kind of a key physics principle. And it's interesting that they picked her to do that, and she was someone Einstein was eager to have work on it, even though she was not a working mathematician in that she couldn't get a job in the field. But she did in fact prove that energy was conserved in general, the equations of general relativity, so long as you So long as you took a so-called global view, you had to be far enough away from things. And if you look from a far enough vantage point, energy was conserved. And she proved that in a theorem. And the basic idea might be if you had, say, a bowl of water or something, and you're on a desert, and the water's in the sun, it's going to evaporate. Will that water be conserved? You say it would change forms from liquid to gas. And it would be if you looked at a large enough volume of space to capture all the water molecules that had evaporated. And so that's the basic idea. She proved that, but she also proved something else at the same time, somewhat related to just conservation laws in general. She said every so-called continuous symmetry is conservation law. And that's a little bit abstract, but I can say that the discovery of hers, which was made maybe, I think published around 1980, has been a guiding principle in physics ever since. And when particle physicists try to have discovered new particles, they've often thought about symmetries first, and then how these symmetries may be embodied in certain particles. And so Emmy Noether's principles and her theorem that she proved about the link between symmetry and conservation laws is just a basic pillar in physics today. And it may have somewhat sprung from her, it came to some extent from her being asked to come to Göttingen and to look into these equations of general relativity.
Okay.
Well, let me just say one thing very quickly. As Einstein talked about, his greatest blunder was adding this term called the cosmological constant to his equations of, basically, the equations of gravity. And he thought that in order to describe the universe as a whole, that the equations needed an extra term. Now, he inserted this term because he believed that the universe should have a constant radius, a constant size, never expand or shrink. And he put that term in there, this cosmological constant, into these equations for that reason. Yet his instinct that the equations needed something was good. It turns out that he was very wrong in his reasoning. The universe was soon discovered to be expanding, and that was known in the 20s by astronomers like Edwin Hubble. And for the past, I think, 40 years, we now know that expansion is accelerating. And Now we see as that term, the cosmological constant, may be what's called dark energy. Dark energy, turns out physicists believe, constitutes 70% of our universe. 70% of the universe is matter and energy. So the thing that Einstein considered his greatest blunder is actually the biggest thing in the universe there is. It's dominating the universe. So that's kind of an interesting story as to how that unfolded.
Yes, I have heard that. That's actually quite fascinating one. They had what was it on the Science Channel in 2012? I want to say they had a special all about that. Oh, no, I'm blanking on the name. I'll have to Google search the name, but they had a really cool CGI animation where they showed real matter clusters and then the dark matter clusters that are identified only through gravitational lensing. So fascinating stuff. And we are out of time. Thank you. This has been a phenomenal interview. I really enjoy it. I enjoyed your time here. I appreciate all the work that you and Xingtun Yao put into this awesome effort, and I look forward to reading your other books as well. I wish I had more time for this, but it's been a pleasure, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.